We'll be reading from 2 Samuel 6 today. That's in your leaflet, so please follow along. David again brought together all the able young men of Israel, 30,000. He and all his men went to Baalah in Judah to bring up from there the Ark of God, which is called by the name of the Lord Almighty, who is enthroned between the cherubim on the Ark. They set the Ark of God on a new cart and brought it from the house of Abinadab, which was on the hill. Uzzah and Ahio, sons of Abinadab, were guiding the new cart with the Ark of God on it, and Ahio was walking in front of it. David and all Israel were celebrating with all their might before the Lord, with castanets, harps, lyres, timbrels, sistrums, and cymbals. When they came to the threshing floor of Nacon, Uzzah reached out and took hold of the Ark of God, because the oxen stumbled. The Lord's anger burned against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore God struck him down, and he died there beside the Ark of God. Then David was angry because the Lord's wrath had broken out against Uzzah. And to this day, that place is called Perez Uzzah. David was afraid of the Lord that day and said, "How can the Ark of the Lord ever come to me?" He was not willing to take the Ark of the Lord to be with him in the city of David. Instead, he took it to the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite. The Ark of the Lord remained in the house of Obed-Edom the Gittite for 3 months, and the Lord blessed him and his entire household. Now King David was told, "The Lord has blessed the household of Obed-Edom and everything he has because of the Ark of God." So David went to bring up the Ark of God from the house of Obed-Edom to the city of David with rejoicing. When those who were carrying the Ark of the Lord had taken 6 steps, he sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. Wearing a linen ephod, David was dancing before the Lord with all his might, while he and all Israel were bringing up the Ark of the Lord with shouts and the sound of trumpets. As the Ark of the Lord was entering the city of David, Michal, daughter of Saul, watched from a window. And when she saw King David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. They brought the Ark of the Lord and set it in its place, but inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And David sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings before the Lord. After he had finished sacrificing burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord Almighty. Then he gave a loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisins to each person in the whole crowd of Israelites, both men and women. And all the people went to their homes. When David returned home to bless his household, Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, "How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, going around half naked in full view of the slave girls of his servants, as any vulgar fellow would." David said to Michal, "It was before the Lord who chose me, rather than your father or anyone from his house, when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord. I will become even more undignified than this, and I will be humiliated in my own eyes. But by these slave girls you spoke of, I will be held in honor." And Michal, daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death.
All right, if you open up your leaflets, you'll see an outline of what we're going to talk about for the next little while. Please keep the Bible passage in front of you as well. The story so far, in this bigger and better story that we belong to in 2 Samuel, we saw last week that things are looking up. David has finally been installed as Old Testament Israel's second king. And in the rest of chapter 5, he proceeds to conquer Jerusalem. He makes it his capital city and renames it, wait for it, the City of David. Not very subtle. And he proceeds to win 2 great victories over the Philistines. In other words, the new king is uniting the nation and he's defeating their enemies. So things are looking up. And that brings us then to today's passage, the one that Tim has just read for us, 2 Samuel chapter 6. You see on your outline there that I want to work through it by just asking a series of questions about each of the paragraphs. The first, from verses 1 and 2, why is David bringing the Ark of God to Jerusalem? Why is David bringing the Ark of Jerusalem? Now, I need to start with a quick primer. I need to explain what is the Ark itself. What is the Ark of God? There's a picture on screen. Thanks, Brian. This is a model recreation of the Ark. It's basically, it's the sacred chest of the Israelites in the Old Testament that held things like the Ten Commandments. And the ark itself symbolized God's very presence amongst his people. In fact, verse 2 from 2 Samuel 6 says, God was enthroned between the cherubim on the ark. The cherubim, in case you're wondering, those are the angels. God was said to be literally on the ark in between the cherubim. Notice, if you will, that on the ark there are poles for carrying it by hand. That's going to become relevant later. So, the ark is a sacred artifact for Old Testament Israel. And I found myself wondering this week, do you think there's an equivalent for us in Australia? Something that holds such significance for us. If you're American, well, my guess is the equivalent would be the US Constitution, which is held in the National Archives Museum in Washington. What would it be for Australia? I think, actually, for Australians, the most sacred object that we would have would be the ashes urn, which, actually, in case you didn't know, is kept permanently at Lord's in the United Kingdom because the British refused to let it go. So, actually, whenever we win, they just give us a crystal replica for a couple of years. Why, then, is David bringing the Ark of God to Jerusalem at this particular moment in time? Well, to answer that question, we need a little bit more of the backstory. And of course, the real question is, so where has it been up until now? Well, back in 1 Samuel chapter 4, tragically, the ark was stolen by the Philistines. It was recovered in 1 Samuel chapter 6. You can see the references there on your handout. And it was returned, and then it was stored in Bala in Judah for nearly 20 years. But the sense, I think, is of it almost being forgotten, overlooked. So why then does David bring the Ark of God to Jerusalem right now? Well, can I say, this is a very astute political move from David. You see, he's just been made king over all Israel. Initially, he was king over Judah only, but now he's king over all Israel. He has moved his power base from Hebron, where he initially ruled, now to Jerusalem. And so by installing the Ark of God in Jerusalem, the place where God himself dwells, David is making a very powerful political statement. He's saying that the city of David is going to be more than just the political capital of Israel, it is going to be the spiritual heart of the nation. In fact, I wonder if you noticed that throughout chapter 6, Jerusalem is never explicitly referred to. Did you notice that? It's actually only called the City of David three times, verse 10, verse 12, and verse 16. And so all this pageantry, this bringing of God's presence into David's city, it's designed to enhance his popularity. Because, as we're about to see, everyone loves a good procession. Question two then, what does David do wrong? This is verses 3 through 11, the second paragraph. Now, you remember, actually the picture's still on screen, but you remember, if you look at the screen, the poles on the ark? There were very specific protocols about how the ark was meant to be transported. After all, if the ark is the place where God himself dwells, you'd want to get it right. Perhaps the most important requirement when it came to moving the ark was that it was meant to be carried by hand. That's why there are poles there. Carried by hand by Levites, who have been specifically set aside for this task. Which means that if the ark was meant to be carried by hand, it wasn't meant to be put on a cart. It kind of conjures up the image of it being chucked in the back of a box trailer, doesn't it? Even the fact that we're told in verse 3 that they have sourced a new cart, well, that's not good enough. And so even though there's plenty of celebrating and rejoicing, look at verse 5. Verse 5, David and all Israel were celebrating with all their might before the Lord with castanets and harps and lyres and timbrels and sistrums and cymbals. Even though they're rejoicing, it doesn't change the simple fact that in all of his exuberance, David has blatantly disobeyed God and broken his commandments. In other words, as I've said there on your handout, near the bottom left, there is rejoicing without reverence. There is rejoicing without reverence. All of which is leading to a great disaster. Because in verse 6, the oxen that's towing the cart stumble, the ark starts to fall, and I take it, it would have been like it was happening in slow motion. One of the men who's guiding the ark, Uzzah, he instinctively and automatically reaches out his hand to save it, which when you think about it, sounds like the right thing to do, right? You don't want the ark to fall off the cart and smash on the ground. But we're told, look at verse 7. Verse 7, the Lord's anger burnt against Uzzah because of his irreverent act. Therefore, God struck him down and he died there beside the ark of God. I just want to pause and acknowledge just how incredibly harsh this sounds and feels. And particularly if you're here as someone who's trying to work out who Jesus is and what difference he might make, what God is like, my guess is that this particular story, it really grates pretty badly, doesn't it? It makes God look like he's capricious, belligerent, just waiting for an excuse to fly off the handle. Because surely Uzzah did the right thing in saving the ark. And surely, if anyone should bear the blame for this day, it is King David. Why is Uzzah, one of his faithful, loyal foot soldiers, being punished for the king's sin? Well, in the passage, we're not actually told. What is clear, I think, is that in this very moment, David has failed to do the very thing a good king should do. He is meant to lead his people and to take care of them and to present them to God, holy and blameless. And I think for us as we read this, his failure, the king's failure so early on in his rule, it feels like an omen, a portent, a sign of things to come. What I think is also clear in this passage is that David, who quite frankly is trying to permanently guarantee the presence of God in the city of David, that's why he wants the ark there, I think David has been warned against treating the ark as if it's some kind of magical talisman or artifact of power at his disposal for his use whenever he wants. Well, the result is by the time we get to verse 10, we're told that David was not willing to take the ark of the Lord to be with him in the city of David. Unsurprisingly, David is upset and afraid. And so instead, what he does in verse 11 is that he sends the ark off to Obed-Edom, the Gittite. Now, just some background here. Obed-Edom, the Gittite, technically it's still within Israel, but can you see that by sending the ark away that he had just tried to bring to Jerusalem, David is in a sense sending God's presence away from himself? Well, let me ask you, how would you feel if you were Obed-Edom and the ark suddenly appears on your doorstep? Now, it's been couriered over to your house. What would you be thinking if it just turned up there? My guess is that what you'd be thinking is something like this. You'd be thinking, what on earth am I meant to do with this box? Where am I going to store it? Am I just going to chuck it in the shed out the back? Or, and this is probably what I'd do, am I going to put it in an underground radiation-proof bunker and lock the door and throw the key away forever? Well, here's the thing. If you look at verse 11, for the next 3 months, we're told that the Lord blessed Obed-Edom and his entire household. What a contrast. The ark that has just led to Uzzah's death in Jerusalem, now it blesses Obed-Edom and his whole household. Now, we're not actually told what that means, although I've given you a reference there from 1 Chronicles 26. Look what it says in 1 Chronicles 26. Obed-Edom also had sons, and I'm not going to even pretend to read out all their names, but he has 8 sons, for God had blessed Obed-Edom. In answer, let me just point this out. Someone asked this question at 9 a.m. I don't think that means that within 3 months they had 8 sons, all right? I don't think they had octuplets. That's possible, I suppose. Actually, that's not possible. It still takes more than 3 months. What am I talking about? I know my biology. I think it's just a way of saying that actually God's favor rests on this household and you see the effects. And I think the point about being told that he has 8 sons, well, the blessing of children is going to become very relevant at the very end of this chapter. The thing is, David hears how well Obed-Edom's house is doing, and he decides, I don't want to miss out on that blessing, so he decides to try again. We're now on the right-hand side of your handout, question 3. What does David get right this time? We're in verses 12 through 15, the third paragraph. What does David get right this time? Well, this is like a do-over. I wonder, can you actually spot the difference? Because at one level, what David seems to do seems largely the same as what he did before. In verse 5, we were told they were celebrating with all their might. Now in verse 12, we're told they're rejoicing. In fact, David even seems to double down on the celebrations. Look at verse 14. David was dancing before the Lord with all his might. And in verse 15, this time there are shouts and the sounds of trumpets. That is, I'll put it this way, this is a pretty rocking party atmosphere as the ark gets brought into Jerusalem the second time around. Now, you'll recall that last week I cautioned us against moralizing from the Old Testament. I warned us against just trying to repeat what they did today. With that in mind, once again, for the record, I am most definitely not saying that we should replicate this kind of frenzied worship style today when we come to church. Okay? I do not think 2 Samuel 6 is an argument for the so-called practice of liturgical dance. And no demonstrations either. But did you notice what is different this time? Verse 13. When those who were carrying the ark of the Lord had taken 6 steps, he, that is David, sacrificed a bull and a fattened calf. 2 things to notice that are different. Firstly, they are carrying the ark by hand, as they're meant to. They've not loaded it up on a trailer. But the second thing, and this is what is significant, I think, after they take 6 steps, they pause. And they offer the appropriate sacrifice to acknowledge the holiness and the majesty of the God who sits enthroned above the cherubim on the ark. That is, this time there is both rejoicing and reverence. And I assume that the animal sacrifice is offered as a substitute, so that if this time around the porters happen to touch the ark, they won't die. Not if blood has already been spilled. And moreover, you might have noticed in verse 14, we're told that David is wearing a linen ephod. A linen ephod. Now, that's important, although my guess is you don't know what a linen ephod is. A linen ephod is a priestly garment. It's what the priest wore when he was going about his duties within the place of worship. Think of Samuel, actually, who wore a linen ephod. What we're being told here is that King David is leading the nation, not just politically, he's leading the nation in worship of God. And so we come to the last paragraph then, question 4, how do the people of Israel respond? Verses 16 through 23. There's 2 responses. The first is from the people themselves, verses 17 to 19. Let me read it out for us. Verses 17 through 19. They brought the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. And David sacrificed burnt offerings and fellowship offerings before the Lord. After he'd finished sacrificing the burnt offerings and fellowship offerings, he blessed the people in the name of the Lord Almighty. Then he gave a loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisins to each person in the whole crowd of Israelites, both men and women. And all the people went to their homes. How did the people of Israel respond? Well, as you'd expect, they take their cue from their king. And so they see the king with his complete lack of inhibition, his unrestrained in joy and delight that the presence of God has come into the city. And the king celebrating gives everyone permission to let their hair down as well. You might say, if the king is on the dance floor, everyone can get down and boogie. Why are they rejoicing? Well, as I said on your handout there, they're rejoicing because they are so blessed to have God himself with them. Now, don't get me wrong, God has always been with his people and he's always been for them, but now he has come to them in a special way, in a big way. Think of a homecoming ceremony. This is a really poor illustration, but can I ask you just to imagine for a moment how we will feel when in 2 years we return to 88 North Terrace? It won't mean that God hasn't been with us in the interim, in this lecture theatre, in this bar, in the lecture theatre for our morning gatherings. He's still with us. But how good it will be on that day. A measure, I think, of the party atmosphere is that after David offers more sacrifices, did you notice that? Verse 17, burnt offerings and fellowship offerings before the Lord. He offers more sacrifices. I suspect he's not taking any chances this time around. But after he does that, as the day concludes, everyone gets a party bag. Everyone gets a show bag to take home. Look at verses 18 and 19. He blessed the people in the name of the Lord Almighty. Then he gave a loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisins to each person in the whole crowd of Israelites, men and women, and all the people went to their homes. Now, my guess is that we today, we sit there and read it and we think, that's not much of a show bag. A loaf of bread, some dates and some raisins. It doesn't seem like much. Remember, of course, that back then, in a time of food insecurity, famine was common in the ancient world. This is so much better than being given a commemorative mug or a limited edition plate or a set of spoons. A loaf of bread, a cake of dates, and a cake of raisins to every person in the nation. That's how good this day is. Well, at this point, I want to tell you about my pink box, which, as I said, this is not the ark. Inside this pink box, now, the next picture on screen, thanks. Okay, on Saturday, this is Sarah Burnett and some of the year 8 to 10 Fusion girls. They spend all day here baking because what they have made for us in these little, lovely little cute packets is a little bun that has bread, dates, and raisins in it. They made 570 of them. We gave out a good number this morning, but there is more than enough for everyone here tonight. Just as a way of being reminded of just how good God is to us in so many ways. And actually, because some of them are here tonight, I'm not going to embarrass them by pointing them out. I wonder if you might thank the girls who have served us in this way. Now, we do have dinner tonight, so I'm not going to give it to you now because I don't want you to spoil your appetite. But as you leave, the box will be at the door. Please take one for yourself. That would be great. And yes, I apologize. There are no gluten-free ones. Okay, so sorry about that. Okay. I wonder if you noticed on this day, however, there's a little incongruity. Did you notice it in verse 17? You see, in verse 17, we're told that they brought the ark of the Lord and set it in its place inside the tent that David had pitched for it. doesn't quite feel appropriate, does it? For the very presence of God to be put inside a tent. Particularly when David lives in a palace. And that, of course, is giving us a hint as to what's going to come next week, which is why you're all going to come back. You can see there what the homework is. Please do read ahead, chapter 7, 8, and 9. That will tell the story of what happens next once David realizes that he's in a palace and the presence of God is under some canvas. So that's one response, the people as a whole. Having said that, there is one other response to this day. And that's there on your handout. Michal, daughter of Saul. See, not everyone is celebrating and rejoicing. David's wife, Michal, actually is full of scorn for her husband. Look at verse 16. Verse 16. When she saw David leaping and dancing before the Lord, she despised him in her heart. And again in verse 20. When David returned home to bless his household, Michal, daughter of Saul, came out to meet him and said, "How the king of Israel has distinguished himself today, going around half naked in full view of the slave girls of his servants as any vulgar fellow would." It's a striking image, isn't it? David has just blessed the entire nation. Every man, every woman, he sent them home with their loaf of bread, their cake of days, and their cake of raisins. And now he's gone home to bless his own household, which you think is going to be even more extravagant. When he gets there, he finds his wife at the doorstep, arms folded, ready to tear strips off him for conduct unbecoming of a king. Did you notice that in this last paragraph, Michal is never referred to as the queen? And she's not even called David's wife. What is she called? She's called Michal, daughter of Saul. Michal, daughter of Saul. Now, I think there's two clues as to why and what that means. The first is, if she's the daughter of Saul, daughter of King Saul, it means Michal has been since birth a princess. She has grown up in the royal palace. She knows what's expected of the king. David clearly has fallen short. But even more significant, I think, in being referred to as daughter of Saul, there is a clue as to the judgment that is about to fall on her for her unbelief. Because here's how the passage finishes. Verse 23, Michal, daughter of Saul, had no children to the day of her death. The passage doesn't tell us why she didn't have children. Was it a case of David didn't sleep with her? Or is it, and I think this is more likely, she is rendered infertile by God? I think we are meant to see God's judgment on her, partly because of the stark contrast with Obed-Edom. Remember him? The one who is blessed by God and goes on to have 8 sons. And actually, Michal's childlessness, it is a symbolic end to the house of Saul. Because if you think about it, theoretically, she's Saul's daughter. Saul's line could have continued if she had children. Instead, David simply says to her, verse 21, "It was before the Lord who chose me rather than your father or anyone from his house, when he appointed me ruler over the Lord's people Israel. I will celebrate before the Lord." What we're seeing in David at this point, I think, is that, I've said it there on your handout, David only cares about God's opinion. He doesn't actually care what Michal thinks of him at this point. Because King David knows that what matters is what God sees, not what anyone else thinks. In fact, he even says, look at verse 22, "I will become even more undignified than this, and I'll be humiliated in my own eyes," which ironically is eerily prophetic about what's going to happen in the chapters ahead. Remember how I said to us last week that when we read the Old Testament as New Testament believers, what happens is that we find ourselves looking for Jesus. We find ourselves longing for Jesus. And I think in this episode, we're meant to catch a glimpse of King Jesus' disgrace and debasement for us. You see, Jesus is the perfect king who lays down his life for his people, at the hands of his people. Last slide on screen. Thanks, Brian. I've showed this one before, but I love it because I find it so moving. This is a picture of early first century graffiti in Rome. The inscription there is Alexamenos worships his God. Alexamenos is the Christian. And you see the graffiti, it has him worshipping Jesus on a cross with the head of a donkey or an ass. The death of Jesus seems utterly foolish, utterly humiliating to us. But at the cross, we see God's wisdom and power in all of its glory and splendor. Well, what does it all mean for us? Let me try and wrap up there. We're at the bottom right of your handout. Two things to take away from today's passage. The first is, I want to ask the question, whose opinion matters to you? Because, as I've been saying along, I have tried to warn us against moralizing from the Old Testament, against imitating their example. Of course, the exception to that is that when they do bad things, make sure you don't do that. And that, at least, is one of the takeaways from this passage. Don't be like Michal, daughter of Saul, who is so worried about public opinion and public perception and what other people think that she falls under God's judgment. By contrast, in this particular situation, I think, David's rejoicing reminds us that only God's opinion matters. In the end, what matters is what God sees, not what anyone else around you thinks. Now, don't mishear me. I'm not saying that Christians ought to ignore what everyone else says. We should care about gospel reputation. 1 Peter chapter 2 is a good example. Look at what the Apostle Peter says. He says, "Live such good lives among the pagans that though they accuse you of doing wrong, they may see your good deeds and glorify God on the day he visits us." So I think it's right for us to be aware of how the world perceives us. But one takeaway from this passage, I think, is to ask the question, whose opinion matters to you? Whose favour do you crave in life? Or put it slightly differently, whose disapproval can cut you to the core and can lead you to make ungodly choices? Whose opinion matters to you? How might you answer that question? Well, tonight over dinner, could I encourage you to talk about this question? And there's lots of things that no doubt you'll discuss and they'll all be good, but wouldn't it be important, in light of this passage, to spend time talking about how we might avoid Michal's people-pleasing and how instead we might live lives that reflect David's self-assurance that is grounded in God's goodness to us? Because not easy, but wouldn't it be good if we talked about that and encouraged each other in that? The other takeaway down the bottom right there, God is with us. God is with us. As I've been saying, as we read the Old Testament, we find ourselves looking for Jesus. We find ourselves longing for Jesus. In 2 Samuel 6, we've seen the presence of God come into Jerusalem in the ark. God is present with his people. But for us New Testament believers, we have so many more reasons to celebrate and rejoice. God is with us. There's a few verses there that I printed from the New Testament to make this point for us. John 1:14, the Word became flesh and made his dwelling amongst us. This is talking about Jesus. In Jesus, God takes on human flesh and comes and is one of us. That's how amongst us he is. Or Revelation 21 verse 3, the last book in the Bible, the second last chapter. The Apostle John says, I heard a loud voice from the throne saying, look, God's dwelling place is now among the people and he will dwell with them. They will be his people and God himself will be with them and be their God. What a remarkable picture. It looks forward to the day when God is with us in entirety. And we don't live by faith, we live by sight. So in Jesus, we see God's presence amongst us in the flesh. At the end, we see that God will be with us. Here's the best news of all. Even now, right now, God is with his people wherever we go, by his Spirit. So 1 Corinthians 6:19, that last passage there, do you not know that your bodies are temples of the Holy Spirit who is in you, whom you have received from God? Unlike 2 Samuel 6, where God is just temporarily in Jerusalem, we Christians, we have seen God in the flesh in Jesus. We look forward to the day when we live by sight, and right now, he is with us by his Spirit. Can I say, and this is a little bit of an aside, but I want to keep re-emphasizing this in this Old Testament series, that's why Christians are not Zionists. That's why we're not committed to the unqualified defense of Jerusalem today as Christians. Why? Because God is not there. He is no longer enthroned above the cherubim on the ark. He is with us by his Spirit wherever we go. And that's, if I can put it this way, that's also the reason why we never start our Sunday gatherings with the kind of triumphant, ecstatic proclamation, God is in the house today. We never say that because he's always with us by his Spirit. I hope you can see what a privilege and reassurance that is for God's people today, for Christians as opposed to Old Testament believers. It's saying that wherever you go, whether you can feel it or not, God is with us. You know, maybe that's your situation today. Maybe today you feel like you are stranded in the valley of the shadow of death. Fear not, for he is with us to the ends of the earth. Of course, you can walk away from God. Ultimately, God won't stop you from exercising your choice. But this God has gone to extraordinary lengths to chase after you and to bring you home again. He sent his Son, who laid down his life for us, that we might be his people. Well, I'm going to finish at this point. We're going to pray. And like I said last week, I think it's really important for us to pray when we hear God's word. If we don't pray, then all we're doing is listening to God and we're not bothering to reply. And that sounds to me to be pretty rude. So I've written another prayer for us. Like last week, it's a thank you, sorry, please prayer. They're not hard to remember and they're not hard to write either. Can I encourage you to take this home and to use this prayer in your daily devotions this week? Maybe stick the leaflet on your fridge, or even better, put it on your bedside table so it's the last thing you do before you fall asleep. Look at the prayer. I'll read it out for us and then I'll pray it. But the prayer goes like this: Lord God Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, thank you that in your great King Jesus, you have come to us and will always be with us. I'm sorry for those times when I've not wanted him to be quite so nearby. Please make me more like him and unite me to him and fix my eyes on him. I'm praying this in the power of your Spirit who is in me until I see you face to face. Well, why don't I lead us in prayer? Lord God Almighty, maker of heaven and earth, thank you that in your great King Jesus, you have come to us and you'll always be with us. I'm sorry for those times when I've not wanted Jesus to be quite so nearby. Please make me more like him. Unite me to him and fix my eyes firmly on him. I'm praying this in the power of your Spirit who is in me until I see you face to face. Amen.